This podcast is intended for investment professionals. Hello, and welcome to Elgium Talks. I'm Mark Chappell. Joining me today for another episode of In Conversation With is Colette Comerford, Head of Inclusion and Culture here at Legal & General Investment Management. Colette, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely a pleasure. Now, to get started, Head of Inclusion and Culture, this sounds like a big role and one that's become a lot more important in the industry in the last few years. How would you describe that role and what is it? What's your day job look like?
Fabulous question. I guess so. My role is really to be responsible for Elgium's culture and diversity and inclusion objectives. That means working across Elgium to really drive, support the achievement, evolution, and continuous improvement of our culture and those D&I objectives. Which essentially means working with the CEO and the leadership team, working with the HR director and the HR business partners, and right across the leadership team really to really understand how do we define and measure culture, and how do we develop ways in which we assess, measure, embed, strengthen culture and diversity and inclusion activities right across the business. I guess that role is also about partnering with our diversity and inclusion committees. And one of those we'll probably discuss in more detail is really Legal & General Inclusion Team, so LGIT, which we call it. Fabulous name. And really it's around working with them as well in terms of what their objectives are, how that links in with the overall strategy, and how they can obviously drive, you know, culture, inclusive culture in particular, to help us attract, retain and develop diverse talent.
It's so interesting that this kind of sits so senior. You mentioned such access that you have to the senior executives and that it sits alongside, but perhaps not within HR. What are the reasons behind that?
Yeah, a really good question. And I get asked this a lot, particularly the reference to HR. And particularly because I guess at a number of firms now, this role sits within HR and has done for a very, very long time. We are seeing some movement, particularly in the US, where some of those firms, particularly maybe where they've had a PR disaster in this space. But actually, I think more importantly, that they're recognising the value of culture and diversity and inclusion and why that's an important part of their strategy. So they've called them chief diversity officers, etc. They're sitting on the board, etc. And I guess, so in my role does sit within HR. I report directly into the HR director, but my role is to work closely with Michelle as our chief executive and each of the leadership team in terms of actually understanding what culture means to Elgium, what behaviours will actually help to drive culture, and how they obviously are really important really important in terms of that it's leadership led to drive people's behaviours. But also they have sort of dual roles, I guess, in some sense. They have the role on the leadership team, the role as a business leader for distribution or investments, which will have particular challenges in this space. But also most of them are executive sponsors as well for particular strands of LGIT, so on gender, on ethnicity. And so it crosses over and it's intersectional in its own way in terms of their day role, their role, overall responsibility at Elgium, but obviously where they're passionate about and where they have their own personal experiences that will help obviously take this forward. They have their own objective as well. So each member of the leadership team has an objective to embed, you know, culture, diversity and inclusion at Elgium.
You sound like you're bringing so much passion to work. What is it? Is it this drive for change that really appeals to you about this role? What is it at the very heart of it that really appeals to you about the role of Head of Inclusion and Culture?
I guess for me, asset management, you know, and when I first came into asset management, firstly, I didn't know much about it. I really what hooked me initially about asset management is the role that we play in terms of in society, making a positive difference for society. And I guess what always has taken that forward for me is that's really important. And it's more important now that we really understand our role as an investor and what we do for society, but actually as individuals in a firm, each one of us plays a massive part in making a difference for each other, for our customers and for society. And I'm genuinely just passionate about how do we capture that? How do we capture the hearts and minds of our people How do we encourage them to be themselves? You know, my experience of being a gay woman, that's invisible. Mm-hmm. And actually, I hadn't realised the impact, the positive impact that might have on me, myself personally, and actually professionally in my career as well, in terms of trying to understand the value that would bring and the strengths that actually gives me. So I think for a lot of us, you know, we look sometimes and we see gender, we see ethnicity, but we don't see a lot of each other.
There's so much of all these elements of diversity, and you were mentioning it earlier, but, you know, backgrounds, sexual orientation, you know, socioeconomic status, neurodiversity, to pick a major example. So much of that is, you know, invisible at first glance, but forms such a massive part of who we are as people, as colleagues, as parents.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, up until now, we've talked about diversity in silos. We talk about gender, we talk about ethnicity, we talk about them as two separate things.
Yeah, as
things
if you
sometimes.
Can only be the one.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, we're hearing a lot more about, you know, we're hearing a lot more of the word intersectionality. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's been, you know, that word started about 30 years ago, but it's really only starting to be talked about a lot more in the last sort of couple of years. And we're no longer one of those things. Mm-hmm. And we should really connect them for ourselves, you know, for the business. Understanding that, you know, in terms of the intersectionality in our communities as well, because when we have offices in different places, how does that look and feel in Cardiff versus London, you know, in Chicago, etc.? How do we talk about diversity? How do we talk about even intersectionality in Asia, for example? But it's important that we do that, because as a business, we have an opportunity going forward to really connect with people, enable them to connect with themselves and be themselves, and harness those differences as a strength for our business, and ensure that we talk about this differently in the future. Now, to make that happen, you've probably heard me talk about this a lot, Mark, over the last few months. We need to have better data. Mm-hmm. And I'm always mindful when I talk about data, because I never want people to feel that they're just a piece of data and they're somewhere on a spreadsheet, and we look at the numbers and we don't really think about, you know, what really matters to them and you know, how much we care about this. But obviously, by having better data, it gives us an opportunity to really look at our workforce in particular. I talk about our workforce, and we can talk about maybe customer, how this is playing into the customer world in a few minutes. But actually, when we understand our workforce, we understand a true pattern of, you know, what the numbers look like, what the diversity of our workforce looks like by gender, by ethnicity, by disability, and that will include mental health, cognitive diversity, physical disability, sexual orientation, etc. And that would give us a much better view of the cognitive diversity of our workforce and how that obviously is a strength in terms of decision making and bringing all those perspectives into the business and around the table. And therefore, we have an opportunity when we look at right across the employee life cycle. How are we recruiting people? How are we attracting diverse talent? How are we developing them? How are we mentoring them? How are we supporting them in the work environment? And how do we retain them? Because retention is absolutely vital. Making sure that they progress and making sure that they stay in the firm, so we benefit from that, obviously, moving forward. It's important we do that, so we understand our landscape, but it's important then we have continuous sort of measurement and sight of that, particularly with the leadership team, to ensure that we maximise our efforts into the areas that we need to support. But obviously, we are able to identify any barriers. So if we saw a less people from different ethnic groups, maybe less black population weren't being interviewed, for example, we look at that and we think, hold on, now we can address that. That's a challenge, for example. But we should be able to tell the story better across the population, to our people firstly, but actually to our customers. So I touched on customers a couple of seconds ago. And the reason I did that is because I've definitely seen an increase in demand from our customers to really understand our environment as well as they're making sort of decision making.
I'd like to turn this conversation around ever so slightly, take you back to where you mentioned how you just didn't know that much about asset management when you joined. So how did you join? Where did you enter into the industry?
I probably guess it should go all the way back to how I started my career. And I started in banking. I started in banking in Dublin at Bank of Ireland.
A true place to start in banking if you're going to be in Dublin.
Absolutely. And I remember thinking, this is sort of accidental, but I look back now because I think given the role that I'm in as well in terms of how we help people come into the industry, even financial services, and the role that we can play as mentors and as support for young people in guiding them in terms of your career choices or first step, etc. And so I was living in Carlow, second smallest county in Ireland, where I grew up, tiny place, and I was slightly lost in education. And I remember in secondary school doing some profiling, like some insights type profiling, and it came out and went, oh, you'd be great as a teacher. And I thought, I think I'd be rubbish as a teacher. Think of the poor kids, you know. But obviously I had strength in connecting with people, and I was fine in terms of communication skills, but I thought, I really don't see myself in teaching. And I was a little bit lost. I think it was the personal challenges that I was facing as a 17-year-old, and a crucial time as well coming up to, my leaving certificate, so A-level sort of equivalent. And I felt in turmoil as well because I had these awful challenges, awful thoughts in my head. I felt in a very sort of dark space because there was all of these questions around my sexual orientation. I didn't really know what that was. I wasn't surrounded by people I could really talk to. So it was very internalized sort of negative thoughts for me. And sport was my safe place. I was free. I played Gaelic football at home.
Gaelic football.
I played Gaelic football
at home. To what level?
I played for a club at home and I played for a county level. So I played for Carlow at the time. And I was just out all of the time, six days a week, two nights training for club, two nights for county and matches at the weekend. But I was free. I was free because I had sports really save me at that time in terms of allowing me to be out in a space surrounded by my teammates that actually were my safe space and people I could talk to, talk about sport actually. But I remember Kathleen coming over to me. She's a teacher, and she said to me Claire, one day, she said, "Are you okay? Like, how are you feeling and stuff?" And she would always just check in with me. And I remember her this evening saying to me, "Actually, Bank of Ireland are running some training programs. They're going to do some assessment centres. Why don't you apply and maybe see if that's what you want to do?" And I never had a conversation with her actually after this. And I never really thanked her really for saying, "Actually, you saved me." And you don't really realise, I think, at that point. But I went off to Dublin and we had this assessment centre. And even when I walked in that day, there was hundreds of people there. And I thought, I have no idea what I'm doing. I didn't really prepare for this. I didn't have anyone I could really ask and just get that support. And thankfully, I was successful. And I got a job, obviously, at the in Dublin. And I worked there for a year and a half, which was an amazing opportunity because I thought, I have no idea what's going on. We looked after high net worth clients in Dublin. But I remember the relationship manager that I worked with. And as much as I thought, I have no idea what's happening, I looked to her and I valued the strong relationship she had with her customers. She really understood them, really connected them. She was always by their side to ensure that their business and their personal needs were well looked after. And she was so efficient in how she really cared for them. And I thought, okay, well, if I can learn a couple of things, I'm going to pick those up. I'm going to mirror those behaviours for a period and see if I can do it. But that helped me, obviously, to work with those clients and really understand them. And then I realised after about a year and a half, I thought I'd left Carlow, like second smallest place. I could move to a big city.
Exactly, and Dublin, the big city.
Yeah, the big city that just so small after a year and a half. I was still lost and I still had these internalised sort of thoughts, etc. But you constantly bump into people you knew in town. And I thought, I've no one to talk to. And a friend of mine actually worked at City in Dublin. And he was actually travelling over to London as well and starting to progress his career, and said, come to London, you know, it'll be great. It's a massive, great place. So I just thought, oh, I've nothing to lose, do I? Just go. So I packed my bag and ended up in Liverpool Street Station in rush hour, and it was absolutely frightening. It was the most terrifying experience ever. And I look back now, nearly 19 years later, and I think I don't regret it for one moment. And it sort of, I obviously appreciate the fact that young people turn up in London and it's a scary place, but it's a such a vibrant multicultural environment that you learn so much and you grow so much in. And so I luckily got a role with Barclays, the international private client office down in Knightsbridge.
So I imagine we were able to meet people from all over the world in that sense. Like you've come to not only Liverpool Street Station at that moment, but also within banking and international banking. It's such an exposure to everyone, I'm sure.
Yeah, and you know what? That was the most exciting part of this role. I remember turning up my first few weeks and clients were turning up from all over the world, from South Africa, Nigeria, France, etc. And I thought, I haven't been surrounded by anyone from different countries ever. It's just mainly Irish people at home. And this was incredible because I was learning so much about different cultures, their experiences. And particularly because you asked those questions because you wanted to understand their financial needs. So it naturally became part of your conversation to really understand who they are and their backgrounds and their needs as well, so that we could obviously support that going forward. Some assumed that with a name like Colette that I'm French and would speak French to me, and I had a little bit of French, but I'd have to sort of work backwards and say I'm not French, I'm Irish, and then it just all got very confusing, but it was great fun, but it was incredible. And from there, so I progressed quite quickly when I was there. I really, really loved the environment. I was promoted 3 times in 4 years. And at that stage, I thought, actually, my next step up, because it's international, it's very much offshore, is Jersey, Guernsey, etc. And I thought, not quite sure I want to leave London right now. I'm loving it. So I look for something else. And I ended up in resourcing. And I always think, how on earth did that actually happen? And a very good recruiter obviously persuaded me that would be the way to go. Yeah. Look after clients, look after the private clients.
Best recruiters recruit you into recruiting, yeah. That's what I think.
Absolutely. And I did learn so much. And part of that journey was actually I connected with a resourcing specialist who had a link into M&G Investments and said, we're recruiting for our team, why don't you come and interview? So that's how I ended up at M&G Investments in the resourcing function. And I quite quickly progressed there as well into resourcing manager role, and then quite quickly started to recognise this whole brand thing around. We don't particularly do ourselves any favours here about, you know, PR, sort of marketing ourselves, communicating to talent of who we are, etc. So I had a focus on employee communications, engagement, looking at external channels like social media, Glassdoor, Hot Topic at the time, and actually that's how I really got introduced to asset management and understood the challenge of actually connecting with talent. We did it very well with customers, but actually how did we PR ourselves to talent that didn't understand us as well?
Over these 20 years, I imagine you've seen attitudes shift massively towards, you know, diversity, inclusion, culture, from virtually very, very few people talking about it. And if they are, they're very much talking about it in this kind of, well, who are we trying to attract as talent? Therefore, we need to put on our best face. Mm-hmm. To now where it's so embedded in many companies' strategies. I just wonder if you can add some more color around really what that shift has been like for you from your position.
Yeah, so I guess I started my journey in diversity by coming out at M&G. Mm-hmm. And even at the time, I didn't really understand what I could do, what I could contribute, how could I lead on this when I've been hidden for so long as well. And I guess the conversation was very much about gender as well at the time. But actually, the first network that started was LGBT. Mental health was after that as well. And I definitely have seen, you know, from experience of the diversity project where I joined that in 2016, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I sat around the table with the workstream leads on the diversity project. And it was incredible to see the shift from, you know, the discussions initially around gender, and you know, they were broad as well around how do we support, mentor, returners, how do we attract young people, etc., to really a focus on well-being, mental health, neurodiversity, LGBT, ethnicity, etc. And these are all leaders from those different firms as well, starting to step up and really take action to drive positive change. I think that's really positive. I think we need to, as a sector, I'm talking about asset management in particular, I think we need to, and firms probably need to do more. So there's only a small number of firms that have a diverse inclusion even lead role. Mm-hmm. So someone with a full-time job in this sort of space. And I guess I'm always conscious that there are a number of other people that, you know, are doing this off the side of their desk. I'm doing inverted commas there, off the side of their desk. And that can be challenging. The question is that sustainable? And should it just be that person that's passionate about it? Or should it be, you know, people from the leadership team, you know, in HR, etc., who are actually changing processes and embedding change, obviously, in a company as well. So I think there's more to come.
Yeah.
Change is happening, which is fantastic. But there's more to come because this is not just about employees anymore. It's not just about our role as an employer. It's coming back to where we had that discussion around societal impact. Mm-hmm. You know, our customers are asking more questions now. Our clients, you know, as part of RFPs, you know, but we're also being proactive as well in taking measures when we say we're going out to client pitches. Well, how do we talk more about culture? The regulator, obviously, we've seen some articles recently around assessment of culture and the importance of it and how we're going to do that as well. And I think they'll be working more closely with us as we move forward as well. But also, I think it's just our overall role in terms of as an investor, as an employer, and our impact on society was part of regulation as well, that we take this really seriously and we're being asked the questions, so we should be much more proactive and much more engaged in the topic as well. I guess it's funny in some way, I guess, you know, people say, you know, ESG 5 years ago, mm-hmm. you know, some firms were active, they were curious, they were trying to take proactive steps and we were there and look at the change that we've made in that space. Is diversity the new ESG? Well, it's part of that, right?
Yeah.
It's part
related.
Of that. Yeah, absolutely. And so therefore, I guess there's a question around how quickly are, you know, we going to, you know, I guess the industry, how quickly are firms going to pick that up and move it forward? But I'm really optimistic and I'm really excited to be at Elgin because we're already, you know, discussing that. We're already thinking about all of the ways that we embed it across the employee lifecycle, thinking about the customer angle, working with our customers, discussing it really closely, listening to them as well. And also we're trying to think of new ways that we can be innovative in terms of how we try new things and try new tools, etc. Digital is a massive opportunity. But I also think, just before I finish that, I think it's important that we don't get lost in a bubble that's very UK focused. Particularly because a lot of our firms are based in the UK, mm-hmm. you know, when we have the global market, there will be differences in the US, in Asia, in terms of how you talk about diversity, how you lead on that conversation, and actually what language you use as well. So we need to have a global mindset and a global approach on this, and you know, that's really important because the other part is, you know, it's not just a challenge. It's a massive opportunity to do something different, mm-hmm. not get stuck in old ways of trying to fix the problems from 15 years ago, but saying, well, how do we leapfrog some of this and how do we move into an exciting space? So I had a great experience of, obviously, when I was at M&G and part of Prudential, and I had a massive Asia business as well, and East Spring Investments were out there. And when it came to diversity and inclusion, and we saw them approach their activities, it was quite different, and it was different because
really in what way
they really focused in on inclusion. So the mm-hmm. conversation started around inclusion. It wasn't really a gender focus on there, because I guess in their world at the moment, particularly across the mid-senior levels, is quite gender balanced.
Okay.
So the challenges that they have around, You know, they focus in on well-being. They focus in on caring responsibilities, and particularly for that population, they're sandwiched with caring for young people and elderly care. So that's a massive focus for them. So the key, you know, when they were having conversations, they were driving on gender equality, gender balance, recognizing those factors and recognizing the future challenges and trying to work together on them. And that's quite exciting because actually, in the UK, we are experiencing the exact same.
Mm.
And we're going to experience the exact same in terms of the sandwich, you know, young people being sandwiched on caring responsibilities with elderly care, etc. But actually, as we drive for gender balance, it's recognising the needs of both genders, but actually recognising the commonality of them as well and bringing them together to address that and take us forward.
That's so interesting that looking forward, you know, as we deal with these massive societal shifts, how that's going to affect each of us, both within our work lives and our personal lives, caring for elderly parents at the same time as caring for children, and the demands that will put on us as individuals, and how employers can really support people through that challenging time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've moved on from talking about these things in isolation. Mm-hmm. I guess when we were talking about diversity, we siloed on gender, etc. But, you know, our lives now, it's work, it's a circle of life. It's our work life, it's our home life. And there's intersectionality in there in terms of when we're in our work life, actually factors come in about our personal life, you know, our well-being, our mental health, our physical health, you know, caring responsibilities playing a role. And it's about us, you're focusing on flexibility, having an agile and healthy work environment that allows people to still be productive, still progress their career, still, you know, work smartly. So smart working is a hot topic at the moment. And so our role is to enable that and empower people to do that and take us forward, because we will be much more productive and we will have better outcomes if we allow that to happen as well and enable them to do it.
Thank you once again, Colette, for joining us for another episode of In Conversation With.
Thanks, Mark.
And thank you for listening. Thanks to our wonderful production team and our amazing co-producer, Holly McNulty. See you again next week for more LGM Talks. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.